Welcome back to After the Buzzer for another go at it. Mike Gross and Gordy Jones. Gordy, how you holding up?
Outstanding, man? Sir.
That's good. That's good. And we have a guest. This is kind of a surprise. We're happy to have him. He is Lee Steinberg. You probably know him if you're a sports fan for many, many years as a sports agent for clients, among them Steve Young, Warren Moon, Bruce Smith, Howie Long, Dusty Baker, Oscar De La Hoya, Patrick Mahomes, Troy Aikman, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And we're going to talk about his work and, in particular, the highest profile, maybe free agency, one of the highest, maybe in baseball history. So, Lee, welcome to the show. And tell us what has caught your eye about the Shohei Ohtani situation and the free agency that's going to play out over this offseason.
We've never seen a situation where a player was at the top of his profession at two different positions like Shohei Ohtani. It's been since Babe Ruth that anyone filled two different roles in a dramatic and exemplary way. So free agency was set up to be the Shohei Ohtani show.
Yep.
And had he not been injured, he clearly would have received the largest contract ever in the sport of baseball, probably the largest contract ever in the history of sports.
Yeah.
He can't pitch next year because of an operation he underwent, but he's expected to recover, and so it will take a little bit of finesse to do a contract that both takes him through 2024 as a designated hitter or a player who plays a position, and then to accommodate in 2025 and the years to follow the fact that he counts for two roster spots. If a team does not have to have a pitcher in his spot for 25 and later, and they don't need an everyday designated player. So you're getting two for one, and those economics will be explosive. Having said that, I still expect him to be in the $400 to $500 million range, and it may end up being the biggest contract ever. What teams? Well, obviously the Angels had a chance to sign him.
Yeah.
But Shohei Ohtani had been pretty clear that what's critical to him, among other things, is that he be with a winning team and he get a chance to get to the playoffs or maybe the World Series. So if you're looking at prospective suitors, you're talking about the Los Angeles Dodgers. The Yankees are always in there. The Cubs have shown recently some interest, the San Francisco Giants, the San Diego Padres, and maybe the Texas Rangers. So when teams compete against each other in that way, this is going to be the biggest bidding war in the history of baseball.
Do you know him, or do you know people who do have been around him? And the reason I ask that is because it seems to me like he's got, I mean, there's some language barrier, but in terms of being a breakthrough personality, in addition to a player in America, he seems like he's got some of that. It seems like he's got personality that people will attract, people will find attractive.
In addition to signing him for his baseball talent, he is a great draw. I happen to live in Newport Beach, and Anaheim Stadium is about 20 minutes here. When you go to a game, it's filled not simply with Angel fans, but all sorts of people from the Japanese community. And he is charismatic. He's handsome. He has a great smile. And so he's a box office attraction. But in addition to that, it will enable a team to penetrate the Asian market and probably do a whole set of sponsorships. He's probably worth $20 million a year in deals for the team that he signs with. When eventually he learns English, which he will, he'll be the most complete package and will dominate American endorsements.
Wow.
Can you talk about, Lee, just how you got into being an agent yourself? From what I read, it was like you were a residence assistant at Berkeley and you happened to be in the same dorm as Steve Bartkowski, and eventually he got around to calling you to negotiate his contract after he was drafted number one by the Falcons. Could you talk about how that unfolded and how you kind of...
Well, that's right. I went to Berkeley in the late 60s, early 70s. I was student body president when Ronald Reagan was the governor, vice president. So I learned everything I needed to learn about interacting in the middle of demonstrations with Governor Reagan. I was a dorm counselor in an undergraduate dorm, and they moved the freshman football team into that dorm.
Okay.
One of the students that I had at the same time as Bartkowski was a little bearded guy named Steve Wozniak, who went down and put together Apple with Steve Jobs. Wow. But at any rate, there really wasn't a field of sports representation that was official at that point.
Mm-hmm.
Teams in the NFL, for example, could sign... could simply tell an agent, we don't deal with agents, slam down the phone.
Right.
So it was very rudimentary at that time. I started the concept that athletes should be role models and retrace their roots to the high school, college, and professional community. And so that led in football to 64 first-round draft picks and the very first player in the first round and 12 players in the Hall of Fame. But in baseball, I was representing ball players from Carney Lansford back in the mid-70s who led the league in batting. Yeah. And then with my partner, Jeff Morad, we had a huge practice which had Manny Ramirez and Sean Green and Matt Williams and Pudge Rodriguez and C.C. Sabathia and a whole slew of players.
Mm-hmm. What was it about? What is it about being an agent that appeals to you? What's the attraction? Because you've been doing it for just about for 48 years, so obviously you're fully immersed in it. But what is it about it that appeals to you?
Well, 48 years might be lack of imagination. I was brought up with a father with two core values. One was to treasure relationships, especially family.
Mm-hmm.
And the second was to try to make a meaningful difference in the world, heal pain, help people who can't help themselves. And from the beginning, I saw that athletes were the movie stars and celebrities. And if we had them retrace their roots back to the high school, set up a scholarship fund or a Boys and Girls Club, then at the university level, go back and set up a scholarship or retrofit some equipment and bond. And then at the pro level, get the leading political, business, and community leaders on the board of a charitable foundation. So the attractions of it are, first of all, getting to know a young man, using listening skills to draw out their deepest anxieties and fears and greatest hopes and dreams, and then making a life plan that starts with getting them through a draft, mentoring them through their pro career, having them be a charitable role model, and then a second career. And that's all really fulfilling. And when you see Warren Moon, who sent hundreds of kids to school on scholarships, or work done putting 200 single mothers into the first home of her own.
Yeah.
It's both the individual relationships and the impact you can have on society are both fulfilling.
Lee, when the NFL instituted this deal where you have a rookie length contract, did that take something away from the agent's role? Or it certainly doesn't have much to do with any of the things that you just talked about. How do you feel about that piece of it?
I never thought that a salary cap was necessary, because in the collective bargaining agreement, there's a fee split, a breakdown where the owners get 53% of the gross and the players get 47% of the gross. And basically, everyone gets the same amount from the television contract. So I always thought it was training wheels on executives who could very well figure that stuff out. Fortunately, in 93 was the first year of the salary cap, and I had the first pick in the first round of the draft, and that was Drew Bledsoe, and we figured out techniques. But the 93 cap, we were able to work around. The one that came 10 years later is a pretty firm cap. And so, yes, it's taken the creativity out of negotiating rookie contracts. There's still creativity with vets, but with the rookies, it's pretty cut and dry.
So does that mean baseball's a little more fun now?
Yes.
I would think, yeah.
Baseball's a little more fun, but again, you then come to the veteran contract in football, and the best players never become free agents, so they get redone by their incumbent teams who never let them get close to being on a free market. But there's creativity and fun. The one positive effect of the rookie salary cap is that virtually 75% of the first round for years in football were out of camp when it started. And now we don't have that.
I think a lot of people have the impression that a negotiation is like two people pounding on a desk as they hammer out the deal. but you in fact wrote a book in 1999 about non-confrontational negotiating. Could you just take us inside a room and what it's like to hammer out a deal?
Well, the first thing to remember is that the players don't have a tremendous amount of leverage in football. In other words, Troy Aikman gets drafted number one by the Dallas Cowboys. Mm-hmm. He's got to take the last best offer that Jerry Jones makes him, because otherwise his alternative is to go back to UCLA and spend that first season, you know, doing the new theory of superconductivity or playing the Westford Philharmonic. I mean, the player's real challenge is whether or not they can afford to buy before NIL.
Right.
Whether they could afford to buy the extra toppings for their date, you know, at the ice shop. And so that was one way, but what prevents the type of friction you're talking about is the fact that in any sport, you end up negotiating with the same people over and over and over again.
Right.
So one negotiation is not going to get so fractious and hot and heavy. And the thing we fear the most is deadlock, because players have short playing lives.
Right.
So the whole concept is, can you do win-win negotiating? Can I put myself in the heart and mind of the executive on the other side and understand what his needs are and craft a way where we can both come out successful?
One of the guys you represented is a guy who would have interest to our listeners around here, and that's Kajana Carter, who was the first pick in 1995 and then blew out his knee in his first preseason game. What do you remember about working with Kajana and how that all played out?
Well, you know, first of all, I think in some former life I was sentenced to deal with Mike Brown because I had the Bengals first round pick, and they wouldn't let me represent Pat McAnally back in the 70s, but right. I had the first round pick in 1987, 1992, 1994, 1995, and 1999, and I think if Mike Brown if I ended up representing astronauts, I'd show up on the moon and there would be my So Kajana was the first pick in the 1995 draft,
right,
and a devastating runner out of Penn State,
yeah,
and grew up in Westerville, and he so he had a great future in front of him. I mean, to imagine today a running back being the first pick in the draft.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
So
hard to imagine.
He went out, and in one of the first games, they had a particularly dangerous turf
in Detroit,
in Cincinnati Stadium. No one hit him, but he ended up blowing his knee out, and his comment was his foot stuck in the turf,
mm-hmm,
or the rug. My foot stuck in the rug. And this is a dangerous enough sport anyway.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a traffic accident when you're playing football on every play.
Mm-hmm.
So the least they can do is make sure that they play on grass, which is the way it was meant to be played, and that it's got the give of grass.
Mm-hmm.
It's more expensive. It requires, for people that have a stadium that get converted into concerts or another sport, that there is a cost, but the cost is nothing compared to what a team's invested in that player and their cap hit, which, if the player suffers a career-ending injury, that's it. Mm-hmm. They can damage the franchise for years.
So do you feel like we're now playing on artificial turf in high school and college and NFL, a lot of places, not everywhere, but a lot of places? Do you feel like it's the same issue, or do you feel like this modern version of artificial turf is safe enough, let's say?
No.
Yeah.
Rip it out. It doesn't need to be there. Yeah. What I care about is the long-term health of a player. But remember this. Under the salary cap system that exists in the NFL, if the left tackle is a big star, he'll be making $20 million a year.
Yep.
That means his backup to accommodate the cap has to be someone who might have been an undrafted free agent or an aging veteran. So the drop-off between the starting star and his replacement is huge.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that means that... And until that player recovers, you can't replace him. It's not like players are walking around the streets. So it puts a disproportionate emphasis on injury. And it's one more reason that you want to make the game as safe as possible.
NIL is, we mentioned that briefly, is something that's on our radar a lot because we talk a lot about Penn State football. I cover Penn State football. So has that entered your world at all yet? Are you involved with college athletes?
Well, it really goes earlier than that because you now have high school athletes. Incidentally, that same year as I was doing at Kajana, my other client in the first five picks of the round was Terry Collins.
Huh. So, our old pal from Lebanon, Pennsylvania. Yep.
There you go. So that was fun. So this has been a revolution in NIL because, first of all, what it means for agents is that the earliest I would meet a football college player would be coming up on the draft year, whether it's junior or senior.
Yeah.
Now, all of a sudden, if there's a promising high school quarterback and a marketing agent ends up signing him who is also an agent that does pro contracts, and you don't reach out at that point, you'll never get a chance to talk to a player.
Yeah.
So it's moved the whole age concept earlier.
Yeah.
It's no one expected it was going to be used as a tool for recruiting or transfer portal. Mm-hmm. But now those schools with collectives that pool alumni money are able to go to a high school player and say, well, if you come here, we'll give you $5 million guaranteed in NIL. Or if you transfer schools, we'll do this. So it's really created a two-tiered system where the top four conferences are going to get all the best players, and the rest of football or basketball will be at a different level. And I think ultimately you'll have four conferences that play essentially quasi-professional sports.
Yeah, seems like it's headed that way.
And then you have the rest, and I think the NCAA dissolves and is no longer needed by those conferences because they can negotiate television contracts and they can do their own rules. And so I think it's been a revolution. The combination of NILs and conference realignment has changed forever the landscape of college sports.
Yeah. Now they've got the end of the rainbow of this, or I don't know if it's the rainbow, but at the end of this, maybe, is a union and collective bargaining for college athletes. Think that's likely?
Right.
You think that's happening?
Yes. I think eventually, there are lawsuits right now. There's one going on with SC where the players want is to become employees.
Yeah.
And the irony is they could have avoided all this if the NCAA and colleges had been a little more foresightful. If they had taken the players that come from families that have economic need and allowed them to have more money, not $15 million, probably $10,000.
Yeah, right.
Players
right.
would have been pretty happy.
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah, that's an excellent point. Yeah. Here's another thing that interests me. You have had a number of guys over the years that have gone from player to a media career. Steve Young is an obvious example. Troy Aikman is maybe a more obvious one. Howie Long, another one. So when they make that transition, what's your role in helping them make that transition? And again, is that kind of negotiating deals? Is that similar to like negotiating with ESPN? Is that sort of similar to negotiating with the New York Giants or whatever?
It's identical, except for the fact that every person is a free agent, depending on what they have in their contract. So what you're looking to do is lead the process. So in the case of Troy, he knew the broadcast would be in his future, and he went and did games in NFL Europe. So you're looking for opportunity to have a player do his own radio show or TV show or do some commentary while they're still playing. So the time to anticipate second career is during the off seasons while they're still playing the sport. And so I would ask each player who walked into my office, what other skills do you have or interests that other than simply being an athlete?
Troy is a guy that, maybe this is just me, but he did not strike me, just based on the interviews he did as a player and stuff like that, he did not strike me as a guy that was a natural for broadcasting. Steve Young kind of did.
Here's the thing about Troy. He was quarterbacking the Dallas Cowboys during some of the most tumultuous times.
Yeah.
They had a massive press corps there. There were scandals. There were controversies. They needed one figure to be stable, secure,
and not express
his opinions. In his private life, Troy always had a lot of strong opinions, and he was funny. Mm-hmm. But he didn't show any of that. So you're right that in the projection you made, it's just that he was playing a role as the starting quarterback of America's team, and they needed him not to be controversial, not to be outspoken, you know, to sort of hold things together.
How do you feel about, I mean, it's the movie Jerry Maguire is often said that it was inspired by your career, and I know you made a cameo in it and you consulted on it. What is your view of the movie, and how realistic, I guess, is agenting portrayed in that movie?
One of the things I did with our technical advisor, and Cameron asked me if he could follow me around for a film that would involve a sports agency. He went to the NFL draft in New York, where I had Drew Bledsoe pick first, and he went up to the press conference with Bill Parcells, and he went to the league meetings for showing off a free agent, came to a number of games, came to the Super Bowl party, so he got to see that world, and I told him lots of stories. Part of my job was to vet the script to make sure that the willing suspension of disbelief that holds you in a picture.
Right.
Sports fans know if the dialogue's phony. They know if the look is wrong. So, except for one scene, we did the best possible there to make it real. And now there's a scene where, towards the end of the movie, Rod Tidwell, the Cuba Gooding character, gets a concussion, and about 5 minutes later, he's dancing in the end zone.
Right.
Now, that wasn't realistic.
That was a little far-fetched,
I think he captured the feel, the relationship between the agent and the player, the family relate. I think it got it right.
I would think in particular the concussion thing would strike home with you, because you don't you have a yearly concussion conference that you head?
I do. Back in the 90s, I had a crisis of conscience because I was representing roughly some weekends almost half the starting quarterbacks, and they kept getting hit in the head, and we would go to doctors and say, you know, what are the long-term consequences? How many or too many? And they had no answers. So I held the first concussion conference in, I think, 1993 or 1994, and Troy Aikman and Drew Bledsoe and Steve Young and Warren Moon and Rob Johnson, a number of players came. And we had neurologists talking about the field, and eventually at one of the conferences, I've had 17, we had Dr. Bennett Amalu and some other people tell us that three or more occasions an exponentially higher risk of Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, premature senility, chronic traumatic encephalopathy, and depression. So I call it a ticking time bomb, undiagnosed health epidemic. And a number of different changes have been, have occurred, including a concussion protocol. The Ivy League is playing, Ivy League is playing without hitting during training camp or practices.
Right.
So that's cut things down a lot. And there are some new treatments that operate under neuroplasticity, so they can actually rewire the brain. One's called RTMS, and the other is necessary brain training. And so there's more hope now than there's been, but, you know, we want to make it as safe as possible.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, the helmet redesign, and they've kind of stiffened up the roughing the passer rules too. But do you believe quarterbacks in particular are any safer than they were before?
Yes, I do, because they call those calls. That's first of all. Second of all, we've got a thriving movement going on that doesn't have young kids playing tackle football. They're playing flag football instead. So that's a good thing. They're teaching blocking and tackling techniques to zone ball in the head. And as you mentioned, they're flagging when it does occur. And people are experimenting with whether or not how little contact you actually need in training camp or practice before you go into a game. Mm-hmm. And we'll never eliminate the concussions, but every year at our Super Bowl party, we gather the state-of-the-art neurologists and helmet manufacturers and other folks together. Playing surface is part of it. So
yeah,
we talked
right.
about grass, mm-hmm. less concussions on grass.
I would think Aikman in particular could talk to this because he doesn't know how many concussions he suffered, correct?
So here's the truth about football.
Mm-hmm.
When the offensive lineman hits the defensive lineman's line of scrimmage, it produces a low-level subconcussive event,
mm-hmm.
a little bit over the chains. So you could have an offensive lineman walk out of football with 10,000 subconcussive hits in high school, college, and the pros, none of which have been diagnosed and none of which he's aware of. The player just feels a little stunned, but that's how they always feel after the hit.
Right.
So they can come out of the sport, and the aggregate of those sub-concussive hits ends up doing the same thing to getting knocked out 3 or 4 times.
Interesting.
Wow. Okay. Lee, are you... have you slowed down? How long are you going to keep doing this? I don't even know how old you are, but it seems like you've been on the landscape for a long time. Do you still want to do it? Where are you with career and...
I'm still co-representing a group of players, and people call every year that want to be represented. You know, I'm also in the middle of writing my third book, and I'm out taught at 3 different college campuses. I've spoken on 85 of them. I've got a health and wellness program I'm working on that uses hyperbaric oxygen, stem cells, red, white, and light therapy, NanoV, because... The question is, at the end of a game, most games in every sport are coming closer to being tied at the end. And so, take a football game, most of them are coming down to the last quarter, and a lot of them to the last play or drive. So the question is, could you stimulate performance? Could you stimulate productivity in those critical moments, and then can you bring players back to health quicker? And there's a whole lot of biomed breakthroughs happening that everyone else can use too.
Hey, oh, that's pretty cool. I'm intrigued.
Before we let you go, Lee, I wanted to talk to you. You recently celebrated 13 years of sobriety, correct?
Yeah.
Could you talk about what that journey has been like for you? Because I know it was a lot of public stuff before you embarked on this journey. What has it been like for you?
So I've been open about the fact that I had struggles with alcohol and the hope that if there's someone still struggling out there that's depressed or despondent or hopeless, that they know there is hope.
Right.
And so what I did is I had to break denial about the fact that I had a problem and take a pause in my life. And I found a 12-step program that I worked with a unique fellowship and said, you know, if nothing else in this lifetime, I'm going to be a good father and I'm going to be sober. And so you have to have a routine and work at it. But you know, in March it will be 14 years, and I recommend it to anyone who's struggling.
Congratulations on that.
Yeah, that's great.
We certainly wish you the well with everything, but especially that.
Lee, thanks very much. We really appreciate this. It's been a lot of fun, really interesting, and kind of a change of pace for us. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
All righty.
Okay, thank you. Be well. Lee Steinberg.
Yeah,
that was cool. That was a great conversation with a guy who's really been fully immersed in a lot of different sports and a very high-profile guy, and really has done some great things in a lot of arenas over the years. So
it's interesting how you get to, it sounds like he got to a point in his life where he said, well, now, you know, maybe I can help get football safer, you know, and maybe he did a little bit.
When I was reading before we started, I was kind of surprised that he had ventured into that. But then again, it makes sense because it benefits him too, right?
Yeah, it does benefit him too. That's exactly right. Yeah. And it benefits the teams, but they don't seem like they feel like it benefits. No, they don't act like it benefits.
It seems like they're more concerned about the bottom line and how players are depreciable assets and replaceable assets. And there seems to be that is about the NFL, which is, you know, one of the things that we don't think about, you know, because of the pageant and the fans and everything
else. Oh, the pageantry.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's right.
All that stuff.
And the other thing about this that I think is so interesting is that this artificial turf issue, which we seemed to put to bed 30 years ago,
not really,
is now back. Mm-hmm. And the same, I think, I mean, I'm not an expert on this, but I think essentially the same kind of surface that most NFL teams are playing on, high schools are playing on.
Exactly. With the pellets, right? Those little pellets.
Yeah.
I keep remembering that time when Penn State played at Nebraska, and what was it, their kicker got one of those in his eye, and then he couldn't play in the game?
I forgot about that.
That was 10 years ago.
That's right, and I haven't heard anything about that since.
No.
I haven't heard that happen.
I'm surprised it doesn't happen more often, to be honest with you. But yeah, I speaking of artificial, there's two things about artificial turf that really come top of mind. The one is how at the Vet, which apparently was like the worst artificial surface of all, Wendell Davis, who played for the Bears, he blew out both knees just jumping for a pass in a game against the Eagles years and years ago. And the other one is the one we touched on during our conversation with Lee, and that was Kajana Carter, and that was in the Pontiac Silverdome, where the Lions played their home games for a long time. Very first preseason game, he messed up his knee, and he was never... I thought he was going to be a great player.
Yeah, I thought he was going to be like a Hall of Fame type player. One of those guys. Maybe not, you never know. But
I thought he was going to be great.
Yeah.
Because he was with the Bengals, and I thought that was the perfect pick, that he was going to be a great player. Now, I wonder, the other thing alongside that is, I wonder if, like, just this technology as far as repairing knees... If that would have been in place, what's now in place?
I think
that's
what I was about to say. Yeah. I think you're probably right about that.
Because that was 1995.
That's a shame, because he was really good.
Oh my God!
Yeah, he was really good. It's amazing though that he was the number one pick.
And it would never happen anymore. Yeah,
certainly not, and we understand why.
Sure,
I think that makes sense, but.
Yeah, so that was a great conversation. I really enjoyed hearing his perspective on a lot of things. Obviously, a really thoughtful, really bright guy, and has done a lot of great things. And his one of the things that jumped out at me was in 1988, he negotiated a 40-year, $42 million contract for Steve Young with that L.A. Express of the USFL. So I'm guessing Steve didn't quite see all of that $42 million.
Yeah, perhaps not. But what an interesting career he had.
Yeah.
Steve Young. And he ended up being a backup for a while behind Joe Montana, and then ended up, I think he's a little underrated, frankly.
I think he is.
What a player.
I agree. It was like because of who he followed. You know?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. But his metrics are really good.
Yeah.
He was certainly a dual threat guy. Yeah. And he was, he was the best player on a team that won a Super Bowl.
And he was the best player in that Super Bowl, too. He threw six touchdown passes against San Diego. Yeah, just a really exceptional player. And I think he might have, if not the top, one of the top completion percentages ever.
Yeah. And for good, like, yards per attempt, all of his metrics are really strong.
Yeah. So so that was a wonderful conversation. So obviously we need to talk about, speaking of football, we got a big game coming up this year. So we got those Michigan Wolverines coming to Happy Valley, and I know you wrote about it today. And what is your feeling? Do you think the Knits have a shot at them? Right.
I think they have a shot, and I can see how the game could go, where they could win. It's that old thing of. Which Franklin talks about this all the time, which is turnovers and explosive plays. With Daquan Hardy returning punts and Nick Singleton returning kicks, they can maybe get a big play in special teams. Both defenses are really good. Mm-hmm. If you can make it into a rock fight and a turnover mm-hmm. here, an explosive play there, it doesn't look like Penn State is well suited to get the big play in the passing game mm-hmm. against an opponent like this. Doesn't look like it. Maybe, they, you know, it's. I think it's possible. In contrast to last year when Michigan ran for over 400 yards against them, and that was just... That was what decided the game. It was so emphatically, mm-hmm. ridiculously in Michigan's favor. It's not going to be like that this time, mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure. Mm-hmm. Penn State's run defense is much better. Their front seven is much better. And I don't think Michigan's O-line is quite what they've been the last couple years. Probably 90%, but not quite. Mm-hmm. They're relying on some transfers. They've really used the portal in that, mm-hmm. in that position group. They have a guy from Stanford, and I think a guy from Arizona State.
Wow, those are interesting
transitions. Yeah. I think the center is the Stanford guy. Mm-hmm. But anyway, I did my prediction. It'll be in tomorrow's paper. I picked Michigan to win 24-23. You know, I think there's a good chance. I just can't believe that the Knits are not going to make a stand here.
Okay.
I mean, they sort of abstained at Ohio State. Right. That was such a
real downer because it's like they just never could get it rolling.
Yeah, what I wrote in the prediction was, I think their offensive line is kind of ordinary. Mm-hmm. Their wide receivers are kind of ordinary at best, and I think that it's hard to pick them given those two realities. Mm-hmm. It's hard to pick them to win. I can see how the game could go that they could pull it off, and I think it's going to be close. I think they're going to make a stand at home. Mm-hmm.
That would be interesting.
But I picked Michigan to win.
I wondered what you make of Nick Singleton's season to date, because I don't see it. We don't have those, speaking of explosive plays, we haven't seen that from him this year. How much of that is him? How much of it is the line? I mean, what do we make of this kid at this point?
He's not as good at running inside mm-hmm. and making people miss as Catron Allen. Mm-hmm. I think we can say that clearly now. Mm-hmm. Do they need to develop a quick pitch game mm-hmm. to get him outside? It almost seems like at times now, and you rarely think this, but maybe he should be kicking it outside a little more. Mm-hmm. You know, it almost feels like that with him a little bit. His instincts for how to stop and go mm-hmm. and how to, you know, spin move and how to turn mm-hmm. a 4-yard run into a 6 or 7-yard run are just not mm-hmm. that great. Catron Allen has that, mm-hmm. really has that. They're going to continue to share the load. Franklin has said it's mm-hmm. we're not changing the way we use them, but maybe, I mean, in terms of reps, we're not going to change the way we use them. But maybe they can develop a quick jet sweep thing, a quick pitch thing. We don't see much of that.
It's interesting. Which leads to an interesting observation about how teams, or if teams, keep something in reserve for games like this. I think we saw that when Joe Paterno coached there, certainly. When they played big games, it looked like they opened up a different playbook on occasion.
A lot of times,
Here's an example. They played at Alabama the year they won in 1986, and they had like an inside reverse featuring DJ Dozier and Blair Thomas. And
nice.
Hadn't seen it all year, but it was like, and it was a touchdown. It was like a 5-yard touchdown play. You know, it's, so I don't know if they have a bag of tricks. This would be a good week to open it.
Yeah, I don't know either. It seems to me like this short yardage package that they have, right. which is similar to what the Eagles do, actually, right. mm-hmm. where they kind of go into T formation almost. It seems to me that they've underutilized that mm-hmm. this year. So maybe we're going to see a little bit of that mm-hmm. In short yardage situations, but that's more of a specialist thing than mm-hmm. something where you're trying to fool them for a big play. Mm-hmm. But that's a piece of it. Mm-hmm. Their tight ends are very good. They haven't thrown that much to the running backs. Maybe that's a way to involve Singleton. Mm-hmm. I'm really interested in this game. There's a lot swirling around this, and we, as everybody knows who's paying attention to the sport, and some mm-hmm. of it is with the whole Michigan thing. But this is, and also because of what's happening next year in this sport. Mm-hmm. This is the last time for this dynamic in the big with a Big Ten East division mm-hmm. and Penn State, pushing the thing, the rock up the hill against these two programs and having these two watershed games every year. This is the last time that's going
to
happen.
Isn't that amazing to think
they're not playing Michigan next year?
Yeah, that's amazing to me to even think about. But, you know, should they pull it off this week? I mean, it could very well set up a scenario similar to 2016 when they went to the Big Ten Championship game. They beat actually, that year, they beat Ohio State, lost to Michigan.
Yeah.
But what was it? Ohio State beat Michigan, right? And and then Penn State won the division. Since this year, they lose to Ohio State, but if they beat Michigan and Michigan beats Ohio State, would they win, or how does the tiebreaker work?
As of now, you can't. You'll laugh at this.
Good.
it will come down to what is actually like the fifth or sixth tiebreaker.
Thank God.
Which is the conference record of the teams that you played in the West Division.
Okay, I think I remember reading that in your piece.
And right now, the Knits would win that.
Yeah. Isn't that amazing?
I think part of it is they don't have Purdue on their schedule.
Isn't that amazing?
I think, as I remember, the other two do. And they, of course, they have Iowa, which might end up
winning
Iowa
the West.
Might end up 9-3, 10-2, and averaging 8 points a game. It's unbelievable. They've scored 82 points this year.
I remember reading that in your column, too. It's like, I thought it was a misprint. I literally thought it was a misprint.
Yeah,
how is this
even
possible?
I did, too, when I saw it, and I went back and looked, and it's not a misprint. It's unbelievable.
It's like they've sent it back to the Niall Kinnick days.
I just read a piece today about this. Iowa and Rutgers this week.
Mm-hmm.
The over and under is 28.
Oh, dear God.
Which is the guy from some sports book said it's the lowest one at least since 2000. Mm-hmm. He can't go back for 28.
I watched a little of the Rutgers Ohio State game, and Rutgers was in it until the guy threw an interception and they ran it back 90 yards. They were in the game.
Yeah.
They really had a shot at it.
Yeah, they competed at Ohio State, and they competed somewhat at Michigan, too. That kind of got away from them late. But
I mean, my point being, I mean, Penn State still has them, right? So that's not necessarily a gimme.
They still have to play after this. They still have Rutgers and Michigan State.
So Rutgers is not a gimme, I don't think.
Yeah, Rutgers is pretty
especially
good.
Where it falls in the schedule.
And that's the thing. It is at home,
mm-hmm.
But they play defense pretty well,
mm-hmm.
And they have a quarterback who was a big time recruit.
Boy, he didn't look very good to me.
He has not developed.
He looked like a good athlete, but not a good passer.
He's a dual threat guy, athletic.
Yeah,
it hasn't happened for him yet. If it had happened for him, they might. Might really be onto something. Chiano's a good coach.
Seems like he really knows what he's doing. Yeah. And it's the quintessential guy who's a good college coach but not a good pro coach.
Yeah. Here's something about Chiano. When they played Michigan, which was in September, he's running off the field at halftime.
Right.
And they do that interview where they come up and he says, there's some stuff going on out here.
Oh.
And then he said, there's some stuff going on. And then the person asked him, and he said, there's some stuff going on that shouldn't be.
Wow. So
But we're going to get that fixed. We're going to get that fixed right now. We're going to go in here and get that fixed
right
now.
So he was onto the
Nobody knew what he was talking about at the time.
And nobody, the reporter didn't ask a follow-up?
Well, no. It was one of those fast, Could have. That's
should've.
Fair.
Should have.
That's fair. Like, what do you mean, coach? What do you... I don't know that it really even came up after the game either, right? But maybe... You know, all the guys are in the press box. Maybe they're not watching that.
Probably not.
Yeah. So anyway, now we know what he was talking about, right?
The whole sign-stealing thing. So he was onto it then.
Yeah.
And this, how many weeks ago was this?
That was in September, and this didn't break until October 25th.
I was going to say, it's fairly recently.
More than a month.
Yeah.
I think it was September 23rd.
Isn't that bizarre in this day and age that something like that doesn't get noticed in a media age?
Yeah.
Wow, that's incredible.
Yeah.
That's really interesting to think about.
Yeah.
Wow.
That was one of the things I wrote about. I threw that in the column.
That's a good note for sure.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
It's interesting. So, anyway, if we haven't heard anything now, I think Harbaugh is going to be on the sidelines on Saturday if we haven't heard anything by now. I mean, they travel tomorrow.
But anyway, I mean, a thing like this, a quote-unquote scandal like this, I mean, maybe we take the quotes off, but at any rate, it kind of gives Michigan that, you know, the whole us versus them thing to the max. I mean, it actually aids them to some degree, at least in the short term. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Because, you know, coaches are always looking for that thing. It's like, oh, they're all out to get us. Nobody believes in us. We got to really circle the wagons, et cetera, et cetera. So this kind of gives them that built-in thing, and because it's there.
And that might get old in a couple of weeks.
Sure.
But now,
right? It's
fresh. Yeah, I think you're right. I don't think it hurts them. Here's an interesting thing that could happen here. What if Penn State wins on Saturday, and then Ohio State beats Michigan? So then. I guess But what if Michigan, then Michigan beats Ohio State?
Then they all have one loss, right?
Then you got the three-way tie. And then, what would the committee do with that?
There's a question.
Yeah, that's what's an interesting question.
Yeah,
and that could end up being kind of similar to 2016, where Penn State won the Big Ten. Beat Ohio State head-to-head and didn't go to the playoff, and Ohio State did.
Yeah.
And
ended up winning the conference. in a great game, by the way.
Yeah, that was one of the great amazing games. Yeah, that was amazing, the way they turned that around. They were getting smacked around early in that game physically.
Yeah, they were.
By Wisconsin.
Yes, they were.
And really turned it around. Talk about explosive plays. Wow.
Yeah, Saeed Blacknall, probably the game of his life. Yeah.
And Trace McSorley was really good.
Really good college quarterback.
Yeah, he had a great game. Now here's the thing about that. One more thing about that.
Okay.
Minutia of this stuff. Next year, when they go to the 12-team playoff, the top four seeds, they're going to have top four seeds, and then all the other teams will play each other in the first round. The top four seeds will be the top ranked by the committee conference champions.
Mm-hmm.
So if you take that format in 2016, Penn State would have been one of those buys.
Wow. Isn't that weird?
Because they won the conference, even though Ohio State was ranked ahead of them.
I think that's fair. You win the conference, you deserve something, don't you? Especially a conference like this.
I wish they would have gone to an 18 playoff. Mm-hmm. But if you're going to do 12, I kind of like the way they're doing 12.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I think it's okay.
Yeah, so. I think buys are deserved for the four big-time conference champs for sure. So, is there anything else you want to address before we move on to our next topic regarding Penn State and Michigan?
I think we're good on the Nits. Okay. I'm looking forward to it.
So, we want to talk about the Sixers, who are out of the minute sample size, but I'm kind of impressed by the whole spirit of their team. There's no clouds for change. There's no controversies. They're just playing basketball, folks. Just playing basketball. And here's an interesting thing to me. I went to the game last night against Boston. They won. They hung on by three after having a 15-point lead with 3:44 to play. But just the fact that they have all this wing depth now. You know, they made this trade with Harden. They got back four guys who are quote-unquote assets or in the last years of their contract. So that's their big, you know, contribution to the cause. But no, that's not the case. Robert Covington and Nicholas Batum are very valuable wing defenders and can knock down a shot every now and again. You know, and that's really valuable against a team like Boston, whose two best players are Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown. And in fact, I thought they defended them rather well, you know, as a group.
Yeah, they did a good job on those two, for sure. They really did a nice job on those two. And it wasn't a real high-scoring game. No. It was a 106-103.
Yeah.
And
neither team shot great, let's put it that way. But
especially from the three.
Yeah, and Bede had a really good game because, you know, he's tough cover. The play that jumps out at me is that they're bleeding to score at the end, and Bede gets the ball at the three-point line with 7 seconds on the shot clock, kind of backs down, and then makes like a 12-foot turnaround, a really difficult shot to kind of stop the bleeding at the end. Just a really
and that was really the only good possession they had in the last minute and a half or so of the game.
It really got ugly.
Which was really just him. They were not very good at the end once they got a lead. You could feel.
Yep.
Even the broadcast, I'm watching it on TV, of course. Even the broadcast, it was sort of like in the crowd and everybody sort of seems. And I'm thinking, this isn't over, guys. This isn't over.
Boston's
it's so
team.
Easy for them to put a 10-0 run together and 40 seconds, you know, the way with the three-point shot and everything.
Yeah, I kept on waiting for the Jason Tatum explosion, and it never came because, you know, I remember game 6 last year where he couldn't make a shot for 3 3/4 quarters, yeah. And then all of a sudden he couldn't miss a shot.
Yeah, he's a great player.
He really is. And here's something that I noticed about him just when he was warming up well before the game last night. He looks like he's even bigger across the top.
No doubt that he beefed up. Yeah,
yeah, he looks. I mean, he had the whole thing, but he looks stronger too, which is what we've talked about this before. How great players. They always improve themselves.
Yeah, yeah, they're still working on it. It's a project. Yeah. It's a project, and they're invested in the project of getting better. And it seems like he's a little more willing. I didn't notice this so much last night, but in a couple other times I watched the Celtics this year, seems like he's a little more willing to use that girth and get in there and bang on people
a
little bit.
He's a big guy, yeah.
Which is, that's the next step for him.
For sure.
That's a significant thing.
Yeah, well, they need him to do a little bit of that dirty work stuff just because, they basically start, a big and four small forwards slash guards. So, the big being Porzingis, who had a great look at a game-tying three at the end and barely grazed the rim. I mean, I actually had a really good game. And he can make that shot. He is a capable three-point
shooter.
Yeah,
he's played well when I've watched them this year, mostly, yeah.
So that was a really interesting game on a lot of levels. There's the sitting boovation for Al Horford when he checked it. Philly fans are not going to forget Al.
Yeah, they bring it. Every night.
And Drew Holiday actually defending Joel Embiid on some possessions. I'm not sure I understand that, but it didn't hurt him most of the time because they always had a help guy. I guess the idea is that it kind of slows down the other team's offense because you're concentrating so much on that matchup that you kind of lose your flow, I guess. I don't know. I guess that's part of it.
I don't know. I heard that that they've been doing that with other teams' bigs too. So,
well, Drew is a great defender, but I don't know. I'm against that guy.
Yeah, that's a tough cover.
Yeah, it's to say the least.
But it's a tough cover for everybody in the world. I mean,
he's
just a gigantic. Deb was watching the game a little bit, and she was like, "How big is he?"
I think he's bigger than they list him. I think he's. They list him at 7'2", 280. I think he's about 7'2".
Yeah, that's what I said. That's exactly what I said. I said I think he's about 7'2".
Yeah, he's not a large skinny man. No,
I mean that is a huge. Huge human being.
And he's still right in his prime. I mean, he's playing great.
Yeah.
He's come out of the gate really well this year. I mean, the question is always his health, of course. But, man, when he's healthy, he's as good as anybody.
Look out.
He's a really great player. And Tobias Harris has come out of the gate really well. And Tyrese Maxey's playing. So you have three guys who are playing, their three best players are playing great. And then you have a bunch of other guys who are pretty good players, and they have a lot of depth.
This is something that I like about Nick Nurse that I've noticed a little bit. This is it's not that important, but I've noticed it. In the press conference after the game, they asked him last night about Tobias Harris, and he said, he's doing good, but you know what? He's good.
Yeah.
He's big. He backs people down. He can shoot. He should be doing this. And he said the same thing the other night about Maxey. Mm-hmm. He's doing great. We want more. Mm-hmm. He's capable of more. That's what he's got to give us. He's got to give us more.
I like that. I like that about him because I think people do need to be reminded that Tobias Harris has a pretty good body of work across the course of a small sample size.
That's right. Yeah, and he probably was in a situation where he could not flourish.
Right.
Certainly individually, but he's been a good soldier for them, and now maybe he can flourish a little bit. But I don't know. I just like Nurse's attitude. I like the vibe I get from him.
I think so too, and it seems to have permeated their whole team. I think he's the right guy for this team now.
I think he's a good fit for the NBA.
Right.
He might have been a great fit for Milwaukee. Maybe Milwaukee should have tried to get him. I don't know if they did, but anyway, I'm glad they didn't because we can watch him work here. But he's a good fit for that league. Like I can't imagine him coaching in college. Maybe he'd be fine, but that doesn't seem like it would work. But he seems like a really good fit for the league. And you can see sometimes you look over at the bench and he's saying something, but the assistants are laughing. Like he's just sticking around a little bit, And he seems loose, but serious and focused on the right things and not afraid to call people out a little bit. I mean,
it seems like I think that's a pretty good observation, because certainly coaching in college and coaching in the NBA are two different animals.
Way different.
You know, it's like you don't have to worry about the academics or the recruiting or any of that other crap. Yeah. You're just watching basketball video, like virtually all day. Or you're on the court, like, okay, this is how we're going to do this.
I just wish they could really practice more.
Yeah, that's just the nature.
I mean, they don't really practice, and most of the time they do practice the shoot around, which is not really a practice. But you know, I think that this guy is really well suited to the feel and the rhythm and the reality of the NBA.
Yeah, so it'll be interesting to see going forward. I mean, we've talked about this before, how the Sixers made this move, and now they have this flexibility to make another move to bring in a really good player. And, you know, I mentioned OG Anunoby as being a good fit, a guy who Nurse had in Toronto and likes, and who would be a good fit, because I don't think he's like one of those high usage, needing the ball in his hands.
Yeah, we like that.
He's another like long limbed, you know, tall guy who can guard. I think he would be a great fit, especially with what they have now. But I also like, you know, the fact that I didn't think of Covington and Batum necessarily, and obviously this is my mistake, as guys who that could plug in and really contribute, and it looks like I'm way off on that.
I'm a little leery about Covington. It seems to me like he's way past it. But is it possible that the Sixers will kind of look at where they are and say, let's go with this? I don't know.
I mean, they have time before the trade deadline. In fact, they probably have to like January 1st, because that's when people have more flexibility to make trades. So by then, they should have a pretty realistic view about what they are.
They have time.
So I think I would roll with this for a while. And you know, by then, other teams will say, okay, we're ready to divest ourselves of player X. You know what I mean?
We know it's not happening for us.
Like, here's an example. We were sitting there watching last night, and somebody said they probably need another ball handler. And somebody mentioned the other day, Tyus Jones is the backup point guard for the Wiz. And he's actually a pretty good backup
point guard. He's kind of the quintessential backup point guard.
So I think he would really make a difference for them. You know, and he's only going to play 15 or 20 minutes, but still, you know, he's going to get the ball where it needs to go.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Yeah. I think he's a pretty good backup point guard in the NBA.
The Dookie.
And the Wiz, oh dear God. They gave up 146 the Sixers put on him? Embiid scored 48 and 31
minutes. Yeah, I watched some of that game. There was not a lot of suspense there. The Wiz is not good, that's
a dumpster fire inside a train wreck.
Yeah. And Beal didn't play. I mean, what's the problem with him?
Well, Beal's with the Phoenix.
I mean, not Beal. Poole.
Oh, Jordan Poole didn't
play? He played, but he was in and out, you know, maybe because they were so far behind, but he wasn't...
No, I mean, you would think that he...
It didn't seem like they went to him much, you know? I didn't feel like it anyway.
I think people are maybe get a little tired of his act where he gets the ball and you never see it again.
He probably thinks, I'm going to lead the league in scoring with this mess, you know, whatever.
Yeah, so there's that. Anyway, I'm curious going forward, and I'm just kind of impressed by the spirit around their team. It's like the whole vibe is different than it's been in recent years. I mean, they very well might flame out in the playoffs again. I might be completely off, but right now with this minute sample size, I'm kind of impressed.
Yeah, and it's a long season.
Yep.
But you didn't know what you were getting, and you thought James Harden might just be. I don't want to say. I almost said a cancer. I don't want to say a cancer, but that's sort of what I mean, I guess. You know, but it seems like they've come out the other side pretty quickly and pretty well. And I think this coach has a lot to do with that.
I think that's a fair assessment.
Yeah. All right. It's been fun. We did it, big guy.
We made it. We made it through another one.
At one point, I didn't know what was going to happen though, this edition of the Big Show, but it turned out fine.
Yes, it did.
So anyway.
Here we are.
Thanks to Lee Steinberg very
much.
That was
great. Yeah.
And we'll be back at it again next week. He's Gordy and I'm Mike. See ya.
See you later.